We are in a wonderful study in the book of Isaiah. Exciting stuff for me. I hope it is for you as well. But we have, what shall we say? Well, I want to, we have, feel befuddled. I shouldn't feel befuddled. I'm well studied. Why am I befuddled? Because I can't find my page. I know what happened. My notes dropped and I just slammed them back together without paying attention to the order of the slam. There's what I'm looking for right there. I want to just go back. We're in the what I like to refer to as the introduction to the book, the prelude, however you want to say it. First six chapters. Chapter six is Isaiah's call to prophecy. It's where he's, called to be a prophet. Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Here am I. Send me. And that's where that phrase came from. Is Isaiah being initiated, inaugurated as a prophet? And so the first five chapters are dealing with the challenges that the nation has had and what God plans to do about it. And again, I call it the prelude, the overture, like where all the themes that are going to be developed throughout the book are laid out, or most of the major themes that we'll see them repeating as we go through. Okay, so last week I like to call it a flyover. Some of you like to call it drinking from a fire hydrant. There's so much material to me. It's like we're skimming over the top, but there's so much material it can come gushing. Real simply, the first four verses of chapter two, talking about the last days when God would raise up his mountain that people could learn to walk his ways. If I were to summarize those four verses, it would be so we could walk in his ways. And then, but verses 6 through 10, 6 through 11 show the challenges and the sadness and the disruption of life when they walk by their own ways. And so you have those two contrasts. It's a call in verse 5, come and let us walk in the light of Yahweh. Well, they weren't. They were had abandoned Yahweh, and they're walking in their own ways. And so challenges and difficulties were coming upon them. In fact, the last bit of the chapter 11 or 12 through 22 is judgment. It's a day of judgment. Yahweh, the day of the Lord, the day of Yahweh, judgment. And you notice the repeated phrase. Not phrase, word, in verses 1 through 6, or not 1, 12 through 16, against. You see it, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but the result was a humble abasement, an abasing of the people that Yahweh was against. And we looked at this interesting phrase. You see it in verse 18, you see it again in verse 21. Before the terror of Yahweh and before the splendor of his majesty. So here's this terror where he's against people, against. But it was his splendor. And Scott, that to me is almost oxymoronic that. Here is this devastation that he's causing, but it's his splendor. It's the glorious might, but more than the might, the focus, the power, the precision with which he removed the corruption and left. It's kind of like a debridement process. And the doctors that do a debridement process, you're just amazed at the precision, even though it hurts like crazy. Okay? And so before the terror of Yahweh, before the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the land tremble. So national judgment equals God's glorious splendor. And he says it again in verse 21. Now, look at the first word of chapter 3. For. That's causal, a connective. And we'll just read a little bit now. For the Lord Yahweh of hosts is going to remove from Jerusalem and from Judah both supply and support, the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water, the mighty man and the warrior, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, the counselor and the expert artisan, and the skillful enchanter. Okay, talk to me. Tell me about that, what we just read.
Removing blessings?
It is more than removing blessings. It is that. Protection, blessings, leadership. You see, the judge, the prophet, the diviner, the elder, the captain, the honorable man, the counselor. Removing from society the mighty, not mighty in the sense of strength, but mighty in the sense of the fabric of society depends upon these kind of guys. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to remove it. What are you going to be left with when God, and why up to this point of what you know, why is it that God is going to remove this? Now, we just read that he's against. Mm-hmm. So why is he removing this?
Severity of the loss of the covenant.
Say again?
The severity of the loss of the covenant.
Okay, severity of violating the covenant or consequences of abandoning, say, chapter 2, 1 through 4, walk in his ways. Chapter 2, 5 through 11, the consequences of walking in their ways. And so there's judgment from God. And part of that then is leaving the society basically leadershipless, leaderless. Okay? Reading on now. And I will, verse 4, I will make mere lads their princes, and capricious children will rule over them. Suppose, now, right now, I just discovered this week. It's a Netflix series called Designated Survivor, and the premise is terrorist blew up the Capitol building during the State of the Union. So all of the leaders of the America were destroyed in the blast. All of them, president, vice president, all the judges. Scott's over there saying, yeah, but basically, who's leading the country now? And so here's this junior congressman was a survivor, and he's appointed vice president. And then the president gets shot. And so this guy who knows nothing about leadership is all of a sudden leader of the most powerful nation in the free world. Mere lads. It doesn't have to be a boy. It could be someone without any experience. Saul accused David of when he says, I'll go fight Goliath.
Okay. Never.
You have no experience. He had plenty of experience of rescuing the sheep from the lion and from the bear and trusting in God to do so. But he was just a lad compared to Goliath. And so that might be the idea here, a mere lad, but inexperienced. But it could be inexperienced and naive, or it could be actually dealing with age. Okay, mere lads will be their princes. Capricious children will rule over them. And the people will be oppressed, each one by another, and each one by his neighbor. The youth will storm against the elder, the inferior against the noble. What picture is coming to your mind as we read these things?
Portland.
Oh, man, you just have to make it modern, don't you?
Here's the chaos.
Yeah, I wrote down five words. Chaos was the first one. Mayhem, which is closely related. Insurrection. people rising up, don't have any leadership. So anarchy, desperation. Why? Why is the nation going to be like that? Because God is going to have his day, a day of judgment, to deal with the corruption. I mean, debridement is unpleasant, but it's necessary. If you don't debride a wound, what happens? Pardon?
It's the word.
Gangrene?
Gangrene,
yeah. That word. I knew. I read it. I was channeling Scott right here.
Gangrenous,
yeah. And so that's what it's going to be like. Verse 7. I mean, look at 5. I can't pass over 5 too quickly. The youth will storm against the elder and the inferior against the honorable. Have you seen in the news, in the streets, young people, maybe 18 to 25, just having absolutely no respect for people in authority, like the policemen especially, ICE agents, for example, currently. Just no respect. And that's what he's describing here. He's describing Portland, or Portland fits the description. Let me say it that way. In verse 8, verse 6, when a man lays hold of his brother in his father's house, saying, "You have a cloak, you'll be our ruler. These ruins will be under your charge." On that day, he will protest, saying, "I'm not going to be your healer, for in my house there's neither bread nor cloak. You should not appoint me ruler over the people." Well, tell me about that. I mean, there's got to be something to you. What does it say? Pardon? Not, could be that. I don't want the job. Okay.
I don't want to try and rule over you.
Yeah. I mean,
your type.
Yeah. The chaos that we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
But, and it's rubble. If it's rubble, what does that mean?
Rebuild.
And what does it say? I don't even have a cloak. Or you've got a cloak. I don't have bread. I don't have the resources to be the leader you need, even if I wanted to. Okay? You shouldn't appoint me. I can't do it. And so it could be, don't talk to me. It could be, I don't want to face the impudence that's in the street. I don't have the resources. The job is just overwhelming. Go ahead.
Or the know-how.
Yeah, yeah, or the know-how. Okay. And what? So he says, yeah, go ahead, Michael.
What is the prominence of a cloak? Is that one wore, what was something that would be worn of people that are in higher esteem, or I don't know.
I don't think that as much as just how poor I am. I don't have the resources. I don't even have a cloak. I don't have something to put on to go outside in. How devastating the judgment against us people had been, left them with nothing. And so I don't have anything. I don't think there's any specific designation to the cloak other than, I mean, if you don't have cloak and food, what did Paul say? Having food and covering, we shall therewith be content. He said, I don't have either. I look at it, Michael, more as a depiction of how devastated the nation became under the mighty hand of God because of their rebellion. And so don't appoint me. Don't appoint me.
Yeah. Rod, one more.
Luxury.
Cloak was a luxury. Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say one more thing is that you see a lot of times those that were in a position that had something, they would rip their garments in a sign of humility. And here's God, you know, taking everything from them to make them a humble nation, I guess, or something like that.
Well, as we saw back, what was it, in chapter 1, to a base. We saw it there in chapter 2, to a base. I'm going, you will not humble yourself under me, I will abase you. And so, he's admitting, I don't have anything because of this. He's not necessarily even a righteous man. He's just saying, I don't have the wherewithal to be the leader, and I don't want to be. Because again, verse 8, the word for is causal. For Jerusalem, why I'm saying all this, because Jerusalem has stumbled, Judah has fallen, because their speech and their actions are against Yahweh, to rebel against his glorious presence. The expression of their faces bears witness against them, and they display their sin like Sodom. They don't conceal. Woe to them, for they have brought evil on themselves. Does that need any comment? But think about it. Let's do comment on it. The nation has stumbled because their speech and their actions are against Yahweh. It reminds me of that old ditty, Candy, you like this. Women's flaws are many. Men have only two. Everything they say and everything they do. I told you you'd like it. But that's what he's saying here. Their speech and their actions are against Yahweh, to rebel against his glorious presence. What does it mean to rebel? What does it mean to be in rebellion to Yahweh? Okay. Say again?
Go again.
Go against is good. To ignore?
Ignore to the point where you just go do your own thing and don't even think about the consequences.
Oh, Frankie, I did it my way. Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did it my way. Okay. And so it could be purposely ignoring God. It could be just capriciously ignoring God, not acknowledging that as God and failing to give thanks. Paul said was the reason society collapses. The beginning of the collapse, but that's what we're seeing here. Their speech and their actions are against him, to rebel against him, to be their own boss. That, I think that sums it up, to be their own boss. I do it my way. The expression of their faces bears witness against them. They display the expression of their faces. What is that?
The look.
The look of indifference, the look of contempt.
Sorrow.
The look of you're so stupid if you think God has anything to say to you. The look of their face. What? Probably not a whole lot of pity in the look. Unless I'm misunderstanding what you mean. But their look was opposed to God. Proud, haughty, arrogant, self-aggrandizement. Conceit, you know, whatever word you want to use, their face showed that arrogance, that against God. They don't even conceal it. I don't care who sees what I'm doing. I heard a gal on the radio yesterday. She said it was about the No King's rally. She said, the thing that would really make me happy is if I hear about the obituary of that one guy we want dead. And she just brazenly said it right on the radio. We want him dead. Didn't even hide it. Didn't even try to hide it. It's like, who cares? Now, when you get to a who cares attitude about what you're doing, what does that say? I'm not going to say I don't care what you say, because I do, but what does that say? You get to a who cares attitude about what's going on. There is no God I answer to. There is no authority I answer to. I don't care what you think. If I want to relieve myself in the park, I'm going to do it. If I want to have my jollies in the park, I'm going to do it. If you see it and you don't like it, turn away. Don't walk. I don't care what you think. And so they don't even try to hate it. And he says, woe to them. Woe to them. That's like, oh no, here it comes. They have brought evil on themselves. Now think about that statement. They have brought evil on themselves. Their actions are what bring the consequences, the results. My last podcast was about the value of wisdom, in that you pre-think your decisions based upon the outcome you are going to expect. Not just do what you want to do because it feels good right now or it seems good right now, but project the consequences before you choose what you're going to do. Well, they didn't, and so they brought the consequence on themselves. So he says, therefore, say to the righteous, well, for they will eat the fruit of their actions. You're going to eat the fruit of your actions. Say to the, woe to the wicked, badly, for what he deserves will be done to him. What do you think about those two statements? Say to the righteous, good on you. You're going to enjoy the fruit of your actions.
Reap
say
what
to the
you
wicked,
sow.
Oh no. Oh no. Oh no. What you're going to get exactly what you deserve. Go ahead, Michael.
I'm just going to say, reap what you sow.
You reap what you sow. Yeah. Now, the chapter starts with the word for. It's closing off the previous, or following up on the previous chapter, where it says, I am against them, against, against, against. We saw how many different times he said against them. And here we see the reason God was against them is their own fault. And then he lays it out. You have two choices. You can do right and be blessed with the consequences of following God. That will never be bad when you follow God. Or you can launch out and do it your own way, and whatever it is that you deserve will come upon you. And so say to the righteous, good on you. Say to the wicked, oh no, for you. Oh, my people, the oppressor, their oppressors are children, and women rule over them. Oh, my people, those who guide you lead you astray and confuse the direction of your steps. Who is it that guides them and leads them astray? Oh, my people, those who guide you lead you astray. Who's he talking about? Leadership. Let me read this. 100 years later, Jeremiah said to me, Yahweh said to me, Jeremiah 4, 13. Is that right? Yeah, Jeremiah 13, verse 11. 14, 11. Yeah, don't pray for the welfare of this people. When they fast, I'm not going to listen to their cry. And when they offer burnt offering and grain offering, I'm not going to accept them. Remember what Isaiah said? Who requires of you this trampling of my court? You're just coming in to go through the motions and slaughtering things, hoping that that'll set you free. God, 100 years later, says, I'm not going to listen to them. I'm not going to accept them. I am going to make an end of them by the sword, famine, and pestilence. And then Jeremiah just was just aghast. He said, but Lord Yahweh, look, the prophets are telling them, you'll not see the sword, nor will you have famine, but I'll give you lasting peace in this place. So here's Jeremiah telling everybody, you have to repent or you're going to perish. And then after a while, he says, you have to surrender or you're going to die. But the false prophets were saying, don't listen to him. God is going to give us peace and prosperity. Then Yahweh said, and so that's the thing that Jeremiah said. Look, the people are being misled by the false prophets. And then Yahweh said to me, verse 14, the prophets are prophesying falsehood in my name. I've neither sent them, nor commanded them, nor spoken to them. They're prophesying to you a false vision, divination, futility, and deception of their own minds. Therefore, thus says Yahweh concerning the prophets who are prophesying in my name, although it was not I who sent them, Yet they keep saying there will be no sword or famine in the land. By sword and famine, those prophets shall meet their end. The people also to whom they are prophesying will be thrown out into the streets of Jerusalem because of the famine and the sword, and there'll be no one to bury them. Them, their wives, their sons, their daughters, for I will pour out on their own wickedness on them. Does that sound fair? Didn't sound fair to Jeremiah. It's the prophets leading us astray. What's your answer to that?
But they were still committing wickedness.
They were still doing wickedness. They were accountable, not because the prophets, they couldn't just say, yeah, I'll follow the prophet anywhere, whatever he says is on him, and you're safe because you're following the prophet. There's a religion today that says that. Just listen to the priest or what he says. It'll be on him and you'll be okay. What did God say? You did the wickedness under the false umbrella of the false prophet who said you'll be okay. God's not going to hold you accountable for that. Was there any way that they could know that they were accountable? Did they not have the law of Moses? And so it's just an empty and false and misleading and deceptive and destructive claim saying, well, that's what my preacher said. That's what the preacher told me. You got the Bible right there in your hand. The man might be a liar. He might be a charlatan. He might be misled. He might be honest, but ignorant. There are a lot of reasons that a preacher like me could mislead people like you. And God says it's nobody's fault but your own, because you let yourself be misled. In the book of Hebrews, chapter 5, the Hebrews writer says, I got a lot to say about Melchizedek, because you can't understand it because you are lazy listeners. You're sluggish about your Bible study. And so he says, the people who guide them, lead them astray, and confuse the direction of their paths. And that's true. That's true. But in the New Testament, Jesus held the people who were being misled responsible for seeing that they're being misled. He holds us. What did Paul tell the Thessalonians? Prove all things and hold tight to that which is good, and abstain from wickedness in every form. And so, they got false teachers then, they got false teachers today. The responsibility is mine to know what I believe. Now, I'll gladly share what I believe with you, but your responsibility is, like the Bereans, to listen carefully, to make sure you understand what I'm saying, and then search God's word to make sure it's true before you believe. So Acts 17:12 says, many of them therefore believe. So this is really an important verse, don't you think? It takes the responsibility for the mistakes of a person off of the teacher somewhat and puts it on the person. However, God did say, you lead my people astray, and I'm going to hold you accountable. But that doesn't let the person being led astray off the hook. So I guess what I'm really trying to say is we have all that we need to know the ways of our God. And you'll be able to know of the teaching, whether it came from God or whether it came from man, if you know his word. Okay? And it can never be, well, he's a man of God, you got to listen to him. No, you don't. You have to listen to the Bible. You can listen to him, but make sure you prove what you're listening to before you accept it as truth. That's all I'm saying. Thoughts? Anybody thoughts? Okay. So we come to 13, 14, and 15. Yahweh arises to contend and stands to judge the people. Yahweh enters into judgment with the elders and the princes of his people. Now we saw back in verses 1 and 2, he says, I'm removing them. And here's his judgment against them. And he says, it is you who have devoured the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor? Declares the Lord Yahweh of hosts. And I had some questions about this one. It's very clear that this is a condemnation focused directly at the leadership. Okay? We have in the Olympia, Mr. Ferguson. We have in and in all the Congress that's there, and the various judges, and even the federal judges that are here in Washington. We have in Washington, D.C., Mr. Trump, his cabinet, the Senate, the Congress, the judges, all the judiciary, and they are judging the people. What does God expect of them? He says, it is you who have devoured, and he's talking specifically now, not to Mr. Trump, but the expectation of Mr. Trump could be the same. You don't get to rule just because you have the authority. You don't get to grind the people just because you can. You have a Yahweh to contend with when you do. Now, Candy, that gives me a great deal of comfort, knowing that even at the very top, and this is not whether you like Mr. Trump or don't like Mr. Trump, or would you rather have Miss Harris in there? This is not about that. This is about a Yahweh who supersedes them. And whatever it is, whether they're good for the nation or not good for the nation, and all the hoopla and the No King's Rally and all the hatred and fear that is rampant in our streets today, it's the fear and the hatred are rampant because of people who do not understand what verse 12 says, or 13. Yahweh arises to contend and stands to judge the people. My comfort is that my God is in control. Now, it might not stop the way and the when that I want it to. And it certainly didn't for Isaiah and Jeremiah. They had to go through, read the book of Lamentations. They had to go through the misery of God's judgment. But that God rose to judge is comforting. The wickedness and the self-indulgence and the arrogance, the conceit, the grind people's faces because they can, the power-hungry, the megalomaniacs, don't get away with it. He says, who are you to do that to my people? But I had a question here, Scott. Maybe you could figure it out with me. He says, it is you who have devoured the vineyard. That doesn't say the vineyards. It says the vineyard. And I know when we get to chapter 5, which is just right around the corner, that the vineyard is the house of Israel. Is that what he's talking about here? Or is he, then the next phrase says, the plunder of the poor is in your houses. So is he talking about a specific vineyard, i.e. the house of Israel? Or is he talking about like Naboth's vineyard and his vineyard and raping the poor in that way? Or maybe the two ideas conflate.
Right. Good for him. Because it says, the plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you do mean by crushing my people?
Yeah. So the abuse that they made of power, that's the point I want to get to. The abuse that they were making of their power says, Yahweh arises to contend. My comfort is that when the leaders abuse the power to the point of crushing God's people, he stands up to contend. A picture that is very precious to me is when they were stoning Stephen to death. As they were stoning him, he says, I see the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. But earlier in the book, Peter says he sat down at the right hand of God. Well, is he sitting or standing? Well, when they were abusing his servant Stephen, he stood up. That's the picture I get. God's going to stand up for me. He's going to stand up for his people. He's going to contend for his people. What is it that over in, what did I do with my new, there it is, over in the book of Romans, there's something that I think is tremendously precious in chapter 8, where, if I can find chapter 8, there it is. What shall we say, verse 31, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who's against us? And he goes on to talk about who can lay a charge against us, who can bring us to court, and who will separate, verse 35, who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will the difficulties we face separate us from the love of Christ? Will Jesus quit loving us because he lets us go through hard times? Does that prove that he's not loving us anymore? Paul says, I am convinced, 38, I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. And so, who are you to crush my people? And I'll say it again, I just take great comfort knowing that he stands up for me. Now, this next, got a couple women in the audience here, got a couple women online.
I don't think he heard me either. Ron?
I did not. Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
I just want to emphasize the fact that Israel was destroyed. I agree 100% with everything you said. But we can't, as Christians, expect, since God's on our side, that we're going to have things turn out as a righteous nation.
Oh, yeah. No. He's on the side of his people, not necessarily the United States of America. And was it? Who was it? I forget. I saw it today. Was it Adams? One of the founding fathers says, this Constitution will only work for a people who fear God. John Adams. And when you get a nation that spits in the face of God and walks haughtily, then a constitution like ours is not going to work for them because they don't honor God. The divine experiment may be coming to an end. I don't know. But Hebrews 12 comes to mind. Therefore, receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken. Now, the shaking that the Hebrews writer was talking about was a shaking up of the nation as it existed in his day, the Hebrew nation. We're going to shake and shake and shake, and those things which can remain will remain. Everything else will fall. We receive a kingdom which can't be shaken. Now, the United States can be shaken. But the followers of Jesus Christ cannot be shaken. Now, that doesn't mean, and Glenn's spot on, that doesn't mean, oh, we're going to get to keep our property. Everybody else can lose theirs, but we'll keep. That doesn't mean that. It means we keep our inheritance with God. Yeah, Scott?
I was just looking at this and thinking about it today, the other day when I ran, is that people read this section and they, boy, thank God, this is the Old Testament mean God.
Yeah.
And then I read 13 through 15, when he's only judging them according to their works.
Yeah, they get what they deserve. They get the blessings because they're with him. They get the other stuff because they're not. And it's just a just God, a fair God, not a mean and capricious God, just and fair and loving, because he doesn't want to do it. To the point where he would sacrifice his son so that he doesn't have to sacrifice me. Now, what's up with that? Right? Okay, I want to at least try to finish the chapter. Yeah, I said in my email that I didn't know how far we'd be able to get into chapter 4 because it really has a lot to unpack. Moreover, verse 16. Now, moreover, Yahweh said, because the daughters of Zion are proud. Now, this is not going to be pleasant to our current societal beliefs that bling is good and the more bling, the better. I got my posse around me. I'm the stuff, you know. I'm emulating Taylor Swift, and anyway. Because the daughters of Zion are proud and walk with heads held high, seductive eyes, and go along with mincing steps and tinkle the bangles of their feet. Therefore, Yahweh will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs, and Yahweh will make their foreheads bare. Verse 17, does everybody's in that way make their foreheads bare? Everybody have that same reading?
Yeah.
The reason I ask is because I think the English Standard Version says expose their secret parts. And you know, that's a whole lot more humiliating than having your forehead laid bare. I did some work on that, and I just couldn't figure out, is it just a translational thing? Why the New American Standard says make their foreheads bare, and the English Standard says expose their secret parts, and other versions say that as well. The idea, and you go over to Nahum, chapter 3, verse 5, he says, I will pull their skirt up over their face and expose their nakedness. And so being led off into captivity didn't mean you got to wear your clothes. Oftentimes it meant to strip you bare and take you out, just humiliate you in every way they can. Of course, women in war have a worse experience than men in war when they're stripped naked. They got the extra. And I'm not going to go there any further than suggest that, but think of the contrast between this proud, haughty look, the seductive eyes, and being abused, exposed, abused by the enemy. And he says, in that day, when I lay this bare, in that day, Yahweh will take away the beauty of anklets, headbands, crescent ornaments, dangling earrings, bracelets, veils, headdresses, ankle chains, sashes, perfume boxes, amulets, finger rings, nose rings, festal robes, outer tunics, cloaks, money purses, hand mirrors, undergarments, turbans, and veils. You got to think with me here. Why this broad delineation, this vast delineation, this bullet point of all these things? What's the point? Why not just say, I'm going to strip you naked and send you off?
They're living an opulent life and not thinking about, and they're doing it on the backs of the poor,
yeah,
by abusing people.
Yep, yep.
It's just every man.
Well, I mean, you talk about bling, mm-hmm, and you talk about just putting on a physical show of beauty. It's superficial. See, it's God says, I'm going to abase the proud. And here's one of the abasements or abasing actions. I'm going to strip you gals bare. I'm going to take away everything that's precious. I mean, this soldier is going to see you wearing that and says, my sweetheart looked good in that. I'm going to. Go ahead.
He's going to take it.
He's just going to take it. Yeah, he's just going to say, I think my darling would look nice with that bracelet you got on, or that necklace, or that robe, right? Give me that robe. Give it to me right now. Oh, and by the way, the undergarments too. My sweetheart could use those.
Yeah. Piercings, because I'm sure they
just. Oh yeah, I want that. Rippity doo dah. And so on the one hand, it's exposing the superficial nature of the women who thought that being pretty was what it took. This shows my wealth, this shows my status, this shows my beauty. But what it really shows is the emptiness of your heart. Okay? And it's all going to be exposed when you are laid bare. He says in verse 24, now it will come about that instead of sweet perfume, there will be putrefaction. Things are going to start rotting and stinking around you. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of well-set hair, a plucked-out scalp. You just imagine the the tormentors, the captors, seeing this woman, just grab her by the hair and pull her over. Or she's working, scrubbing his floor, and I don't want you scrubbing my floor, grab her by the hair, make her over here. They didn't care. They didn't care. He said, and then instead of fine clothes, a donning of sackcloth and branding instead of beauty. You think of that? Here, this well societal woman, seen walking down the street with her head held high and all her finery on, I go, ooh, look at her. That's the priest's wife, or that's the rabbi's wife, or that's Mrs. So and so, the butcher's wife, or whatever, you see. And now, instead of all that beauty, she's got a brand. What does a brand say? You're owned by that guy that you can't even speak his language. You have been branded like a heifer. That's what's coming. And it's coming because they're not listening to God. Your men will fall by the sword and your mighty ones in battle, and her gates will lament and mourn, and deserted she will sit on the ground. Ain't got no men. Now, chapter 4, verse 1 actually belongs with this piece. Because chapter 4, verse 2 starts an entire new discussion. Okay? For seven women will take hold of one man in that day, saying, we'll eat our own bread and wear our own clothes. In other words, we'll just provide for it. We're not looking to you. I know you don't have a cloak, so we can't be our ruler. We're not looking for your provision. We just want you to take away our reproach. What would be the reproach of a woman in that society? No children. Seven women. One guy, we'll all hook up with you so we can have your child. Don't worry about taking care of us. We just want our reproach taken away. That's a pretty humiliating drop from what you see in verses 16 and 17. And why? Because they ain't listening to God. I keep going back to Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, the first 14 verses. If you will just listen to me and keep my covenant, I'll bless you beyond your wildest dreams. But if you don't, I'll bring one wave after another of punishments until you're finally taken off into captivity to try to win your heart back. And here it is, Isaiah saying, you know, there's a day coming when God is going to stand up and contend for his people against you. Now, what's interesting to me is when we get over to chapter 65, he says, my servants will do this and you will do that. My servants will have this and you will have that. And so he makes this delineation between within the society, because who's the you? It's the people Isaiah was writing to. Who's the my servants? It's the ones who are following God. Okay, and so we see that here. Again, this is like a prelude, an overture of what's coming. Let's go ahead and read chapter 4 and just not take time to comment on it because, like I said, unpacking it may take the entire hour next week. I don't know. In that day, now what we have here is we have... go back to verse 13, Yahweh arises to contend. We're seeing judgment. We saw at the end of chapter 2, I'm against, I'm against, I'm against, I'm against. I'm going to deprive you of leadership. I'm going to contend against you on behalf of my people. And here's what's going to happen to the women. But what we have in chapter 4 is a branch of hope. So, like, God has hope for their future. We saw that in chapter 2, didn't we? It'll come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord be established, and all nations will come. They'll beat the swords in the plowshare. They will learn God's way. So, Isaiah is addressing the current need for retribution or judgment or discipline, both at the time of Isaiah, but in what's the word I wanted? The allegory of Sarah and Hagar, in an allegorical way. That's in Galatians. In an allegorical way, the history that they're going through represents a history that they're going to go through when the branch comes. Okay? And so we have judgment, but we also have hope. We have purging, removing the wickedness so that the way of the righteous can be blessed. We're having both of those here in the book of Isaiah. Now, I don't want to get bogged down. I want us to realize very simply, say to the righteous, it will be well. The fruit of his actions will come upon him. Woe to the wicked, it will go badly, because what he deserves will come. That's the principle I want us to take from this. And the fact that God would rise up to contend on behalf of those who are being abused is both comforting and reassuring, that when he says the righteous will reap the fruit of their choices, he makes it happen. It's not just put a seed in the ground, it'll grow, which is true. But follow righteously, and it doesn't matter what the nations around you do, God will make sure that you are his, and the blessings come. And those blessings come through this branch. Now, there's some homework I'm going to give you as we go through this. So let's go ahead and read these five verses here. In that day, the branch of Yahweh will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land, the pride and adornment of the survivors of Israel. And it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem, when Yahweh has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning, then Yahweh will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke, and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy, and there'll be a shelter to shade from the heat of day, and a refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. Now, I hope just reading exudes, fills you, imbues you with comfort and fond expectation. But here's some things I want you to do. I get my handy dandy pen here. Look at this word in verse 2 called the branch. I think that's the first mention of the branch, but it's not the first idea of the concept. So maybe you can go back and find where you have almost have to go forward, like to chapter 9, where you see that the branch comes from the stem of Jesse, and you go back and say, well, what was there about Jesse that talked about something that would... So trace the idea of branch from its inception to its conclusion. There is a passage that you will find where it says, behold, the man whose name is branch. It's actually becomes a human being, okay? Then there is this phrase in verse 3, everyone who is left in Zion. I want you to think about who that is, what that is, and how prominent that is in the prophets. Okay, that's step number 2. Step number 3 is this concept recorded for life. See if you can find anything else like that in the Bible, new and old, about being recorded for life in Jerusalem. When God has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from midst by a spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning, I want you to see if there's anything in the New Testament that makes you think of being purged by burning. In fact, see if there's anything in the later prophets that amplify that. If I say the word Malachi, would I be misleading you? No. Then Yahweh will create over the whole area of Mount Zion, over her assemblies, a cloud by day and a flame of fire by night. See if that reminds you or finds anything that you can connect up with that thought right there. And then finally, so we got the cloud by day and by night. And then finally, there will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day and refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. Think about the storm and the rain. What is suggested by that? Is that clear? There's one, two, three. Only six. There should be seven. That'd be perfect, wouldn't it? I have six things for you to scope out for next week. We'll talk about those things. Any thoughts? Any questions?
You need to write them out in an email so that we can categorize each one.
Michael, you just make more work for me. Okay, but it's a great idea. He said, I need to send an email to everybody about these. So that's good. Really, it's a great point. Thank you for that. Anything else?
No, I do think it is a good thought that we can write. If you write it out, then we can write verses underneath it that will correlate the two.
Yeah, I know.